Welcome to Berlin Inside Out, the podcast that takes an expert look at how Germany sees the world and the world sees Germany, with me, Benjamin Tallis.
And me, Aaron Gash Burnett.
Hello and welcome back to Berlin Inside Out, the foreign affairs podcast in association with the German Council on Foreign Relations that takes an expert look at international politics from Berlin. I'm Aaron Gash Burnett, a journalist and security analyst, and I'm here with my friend and co-host Benjamin Tallis, senior research fellow here at the Council and head of its action group, Zeitenwende. And we are coming to you from Berlin ahead of the Ukraine Recovery Conference from June 10th to 12th for part two of our Pillars of Victory special. Now, Ben, in part one of the special, we discussed what's needed for Ukraine's military victory on the battlefield with Ben Hodges, Oleksandr Daniluk, Ivo Dalder, and Terry Schultz. And one of the big themes that came out of that conversation is that we really haven't tried to win yet, as Ben Hodges said. We haven't really committed to Ukraine's victory. So we're having a recovery conference without a commitment to victory. Isn't that putting the cart before the horse a bit here?
It is, Aaron. And I think one of the problems here is that recovery is such a nebulous term that it provides a political safe space for politicians who don't want to discuss the need for victory. They don't want to discuss the hard military realities of what needs to be done to win in Ukraine. So while recovery will at some point be necessary, we're putting the cart before the horse, as you said, if we talk about recovery without really committing to victory. And it's notable that a lot of the Ukrainian experts, as well as the strongest advocates from Ukraine for Ukraine, say, how do you help Ukraine recover? Well, you give air defense and you give the offensive weapons that will get Russia off Ukraine's territory. And that's something that has to be clearly put together in a strategic way with any future plan that we have. And it's clear, as we've said many times on season two of Berlin Inside Out, that as long as it takes simply won't cut it, nor frankly will whatever it takes, because it doesn't define what the it actually is. And defining that goal, which will then help us define the means to achieve it, is central. And that goal has to be to win. So we need to understand, as Ben Hodges and Terry Schultz and others said on our last episode, we need to understand how we're going to get Russia out of all of Ukraine's territory, how we're going to get Ukraine into NATO, how we're going to create a stable security order in Europe that serves our values as well as our interests. Now, we've been discussing previously what's needed to achieve that military victory on the battlefield, and Ben Hodges was very clear that road to that victory runs through Crimea. But there's more to Ukrainian victory or to a successful strategy than the military dimensions alone. And this is a war that's being waged on many fronts, isn't it, Aaron?
That's right, Ben. Right now, we're moving from the front lines into the back rooms on this part two of our special to a fight for Ukraine and our values that's being fought on parliamentary and congressional floors, in the media, and even over discussions in beer halls at security conferences, it must be said. We are talking about this war's economic and financial front and how to win it.
Right. That was one of the better things to come out of a Munich beer keller, wasn't
it? Absolutely. Yeah.
No historical comparisons there, please.
Yes, that is very true. But what started in that beer hall was a discussion that we've been having for months between us and with other experts and other interested people who have a stake in seizing Russia's assets to help Ukraine's victory. At the beginning of this war, the G7 states froze around $300 billion worth of currency reserves the Russian central bank holds in Western countries. The G7 has said that Russia is not getting this money back unless it compensates Ukraine for the damage it has caused. But Russia has now inflicted almost $500 billion in damages on Ukraine by now, and that sum keeps growing every day. Meanwhile, these assets remain frozen, sitting on the sidelines, and not helping Ukraine to win this war. Now, they're mostly being held in Euroclear Bank in Belgium and correspondent banks, but in different countries and in different currencies. About 8% is held in American dollars, 9% in Canadian dollars, 16% in British pounds. But Europe's, and by extension Germany's, special responsibility on this question is very clear, because 63% is held in euros. Now, later this week, we have a G7 summit in Italy where some sort of decision is expected on how to use those frozen assets to help Ukraine, while the US, Canada, and the UK favor just confiscating all $300 billion. European governments, including Germany's, are reluctant. And that's why we hosted a very full and well-attended parliamentary breakfast just last week with members of the Bundestag from all four of Germany's democratic parties. One of our guests today, Julia Siskina, was also on that expert panel. Our co-hosts, including Green MP and Action Group members, Sebastian Schaefer, as well as our CSU co-host, Wolfgang Steffinger, were both in German media last week, alongside myself, talking about the need to confiscate the whole $300 billion. Now, you can find those articles in our show notes, but Ben, you were at that breakfast. What were your impressions of where we're at right now on seizing these assets, and how does that play into our overall strategic picture?
Well, first of all, it's really important to emphasize this cross-party support that was shown for seizing the full amount of the assets from the SPD, from the Greens, the CDU and CSU, as well as the Liberal Free Democrats. There were several MPs from each of those parties there who really get it. They understand very clearly that we've already won the legal and economic arguments. Seizing the full amount of assets is legally feasible, it's economically viable, but it's not yet actually generated the political will behind it in Germany to make it government policy. And that's because we're missing the strategic picture. We tend to overcomplicate these things sometimes, and some of those convoluted solutions that discuss later in this episode seem to be very complicated ways of trying to avoid doing the right thing. And it's worth remembering what Ronald Reagan said that we heard from Matt Kranig back on a previous episode, that some of these very complex issues can actually be made very simple if you really think them through. Ultimately, it's a question of we win, they lose. And if victory in Ukraine is in our interest, if deterring Russia is in our interest, then we need to seize the assets to demonstrate the resolve that we need in order to not only win in Ukraine, but to secure ourselves in future. Why is that? It's because we're not only in a battle of forces, we're in a battle of resolve. We have to demonstrate that necessary resolve that we are committed to actually defending our interests when it's so clearly in line with our values in Europe. This war, let's be very clear, affects Europe more directly than it affects the US. And if we can't get our act together on this, it sends the worst possible signal about our viability in defending the kind of lives that we want to live in future, the kind of order that would allow that. It shows that we have the political will to seize the assets, to fund Ukraine's victory, but also to make Russia pay. And that's about setting the kind of precedent that we need, as well as setting the kind of strategy that we need to win the systemic competition and ensure that Europe has a democratic and free future.
And so today we're privileged to have joining us a very international panel of four guests, all of whom are working to change that. First up, we have Helena Yanchenko. She is a member of parliament in the Ukrainian Verkhovna Rada and secretary of the National Investment Council of Ukraine. Next up, welcome to Robin Wagner, the chair of both the German-Ukrainian Parliamentary Friendship Group in the Bundestag and the German delegation to the OSCE Parliamentary Assembly, among the many hats he wears as a member of the Bundestag for the German Greens. And jumping across the Atlantic, joining us from Washington, Yulia Siskina, a senior legal fellow with RASM for Ukraine, who has worked with Senator Ratna Omidvar on the Canadian legislation for seizing Russian assets. And Yulia was most recently one of the main legal minds behind the American Repo Act, which allows the president to order the seizure of Russian assets denominated in US dollars. We'll be speaking with the senator about the Canadian legislation later in the show. But first off, welcome to the show, everyone. Helena, let's start with you. What kind of difference would seizing and transferring these Russian state assets make for Ukraine? What could Ukraine do with this money, and what are or should be the priorities?
Well, Ukraine has a number of priorities, and actually the damage that Russia have caused to Ukraine is huge. It's enormous, and they continue actually damaging our infrastructure. I'm talking about all sorts of damages, starting with residential buildings, when people are losing homes, when people are losing actually a place to live, and ending with some like major and vital parts of infrastructure like energy and heating infrastructure. And actually, I should tell you one thing that I should tell you about the process of not just freezing, but actually seizing the assets. It's very important source of resources for recovering of Ukraine, but also for the current military and financial assistance. That's number one. But second part that we should clearly understand, that this is a very important political message, that if Russia continues messing with Ukraine, if Russia continues destroying Ukrainian infrastructure, and just in March they destroyed a number of huge electricity stations, then they will be forced to pay. And maybe, although I really doubt that Russians still have some logic, but nevertheless, maybe that will give them a sense of like what they are doing and who will pay for it, and should they continue basically messing with Ukraine and damaging the infrastructure. So there are two functions, two very important functions. as I said, one practical and one very symbolical, but both of them making a huge difference and sending a big signal to Russia, but also to all authoritarian regimes across the world. I just came from Washington, D.C., this week. I spent a whole week there. And actually, I should tell you that, for example, Americans, they feel some tension, not only about Russian, but actually about the whole so-called axis of evil, about the countries that are likely or thinking about messing with their neighbors. I'm talking about China and Taiwan. I'm talking about what is going on in the Middle East. And this is only to start with. So actually, it's very important for Western democracy to send a very clear and tough message to those authoritarian regimes. If you mess with your neighbors, if you mess with other countries, you will pay.
Right, exactly. That's such an important signal to send, that there would be justice, there would be accountability. You don't get away with doing this kind of stuff. But Robin, coming to you a second, this point about what the money would be used for. In Germany, we tend to hear this debate couched in the language of reconstruction. And as Helena mentioned, there will be plenty to do on reconstruction. It will be extremely important. But that's something of a political safe space for discussion. Shouldn't we be talking about this in terms of seizing that money to fund Ukrainian victory?
I think, first of all, we should start thinking not only about Ukrainian victory, but we should start thinking about our common victory as we are together under attack by Russia. And I think this is the biggest problem in all the debates we have, that we are still thinking in the Western countries that we are helping Ukraine out of charity or out of friendliness to an attacked democracy, but forgetting that we are also under attack. Right now in Germany, we have those news about Russian spies working together with our far right-wing party here in Germany, for example. We have Russian murders taking place in European Union countries. We have destabilization, disinformation. All this is happening. And the Ukrainian people are on the front line of this battle of the Russian dictatorship against our democracies. They are paying with their lives for this fight. So we should be in this fight together with them, and we should have this mindset for this whole debate. And then we could come to the other questions of what we use the money for, and also which money do we use and what are the obstacles to that. But first of all, we have to change this mindset.
Right. As we often say on the show, Aaron, the goal defines the means, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And actually, that brings me to one question I have for all of you, for the entire panel, because when we're talking about going from as long as it takes to whatever it takes and really changing our mindset to be fully in this fight in support of Ukraine, not just out of charity, but out of the fact that it is in our strategic interest, that comes down to a question of, are we willing to do everything we possibly can do to help Ukraine win here? So when it comes to the question of seizing assets, the Repo Act in the US, as well as Canadian legislation, allows those governments to seize Russian state assets denominated in US or Canadian money. Yet right now, we're hearing a lot of chatter about whether the G7 will actually seize the entire asset, whether it will go as far as it needs to go, as it could go. Instead, we're hearing talk of some sort of creative solution, which would only see the interest transferred to Ukraine, or allowing the asset or the or interest to be used as collateral for Ukraine to borrow money against. So why do you think the G7 are doing this rather than just going with the simplest and most obvious solution right from the get-go, which would be the most likely to actually contribute to Ukrainian victory, which is to simply seize the entire asset? I mean, why is it important that we do that?
All of these creative solutions, as Aaron eloquently called them, arose as a result of the mistaken view that sovereign immunity basically means that you can't touch Russia's money. That's not true. And that misconception has been cleared up already by numerous prominent international law practitioners, experts, scholars. But unfortunately, it's tended to linger, and also because it's a very convenient excuse. So all of this has led to a bit of a wild goose chase towards these various alternatives, where governments are twisting themselves into pretzels based on misconceptions about the law. There's been this false red line that mainly Europe has drawn to box themselves in and the rest of the G7. But that line has always been imaginary. Let me be really, really clear about this. Sovereign assets are not inviolable. That view mistakes the absolute protection of property for the rule of law. So in other words, to say that sovereign assets are inviolable is also saying that waging a war of aggression, committing horrible war crimes, and owing billions of dollars in reparations is simply irrelevant. But it's not. It's not irrelevant.
Robin, coming to you on that, I'm not sure this is something that's fully grasped within the German political establishment at the moment. Even those in the highest level of government seem incredibly nervous about doing something they think still might not be quite kosher according to the law, but which a lot of international experts, as Julia said, mentioned, is in fact in keeping with the law and keeping up the protection of law itself.
First of all, it's totally okay to have a thoughtful decision-making process on that. And actually, that is what is the difference between our democracies and, for example, a dictatorship as in Russia. Here we have debates on that, and here we have to really think about the decisions we make. And I think it's totally okay to have these worries. And I would also say that while this war is also about rule of law and these issues, it's very relevant to clearly check what is in line with international law and what is not. I'm also in the position that it is the right thing to use the whole frozen assets, but I think it's quite a valid thing to prove whether this is in line with European or with international law. And it's also, I understand the idea of having thoughts about European financial places and the investment place, for example, on that. But when all the G7 is acting, I don't see the point in where the money should go, actually. So this is okay. But the German Bundestag has voted on a very clear motion on that, which says we should use the frozen assets. And I would personally also say, and perhaps in little easier words, I do not understand the point in a country invading another country, destroying whatever it can destroy, causing all this damage, and everyone else has to pay for that. I don't see the point in that, and I'm not actually willing to accept that. I would not accept that in private life, and I don't accept that between states. So it should be a clear cause to make Russia pay for that. I said that in the plenary. I said we make Russia pay. The Bundestag voted on that. And so I think it's okay to have this discussion, but in the end, the cause should be clear on that.
Absolutely right. And indeed, a thoughtful debate is, as you rightly say, precisely what distinguishes democracies from autocracies, which is the very values we're fighting for. But when people in power in those democracies use false reasons, in fact, to act as excuses not to do what is needed, it sets a dangerous precedent. There's often fear of setting the precedent, as you mentioned. That's been one of the arguments used against that. What precedent would actually seizing the assets set? But Aaron, this is something we've talked about a lot. That seems to ignore the precedent that is set by letting Russia get away with this and the damage that could do to international law and order if we let it go unpunished.
Well, precisely. And I think that we would, we've made this point before that inaction also sets a precedent. I think that there is this belief in Germany sometimes in particular that if you, it's only if you take a certain positive decision that you end up setting a precedent. But in actual fact, if you don't take a decision, you'll also set a precedent. And Helena, you just said this a few minutes ago in your opening, whether or not we seize these assets, will set a precedent. Do we want to set that precedent of if you behave this way, you will pay. I mean, that to me sounds like a pretty clear strategic question.
An interesting fact that it's not a precedent. Actually, something that is called reparation. So basically, the occupant or the country which messed with the neighbor should pay the damages. It's not a precedent. That's what actually happened around the world in the previous century. So this is actually the instrument and the tool that is already there. It's not a precedent actually to seize Russian money either, because actually it was Canada who passed the first legislation. And it was, if I'm not mistaken, probably even back in 2022. So basically, they said that actually they can take the frozen Russian money and start using it. Also, during the last week Congress, then Senate, then President of US have actually signed yet another legislation act in addition to the hugely expected financial and military assistance to Ukraine. There was another legislation act passed by U.S. Congress. It was a legislation about seizing actually Russian assets. And currently, according to my information, there are about $5 billion in the United States that can be seized and used to actually provide assistance to Ukraine. Talking about Germany, Germany has about 4 billion euros of various kind of Russian assets. This includes not only money of Russian central bank, but actually private assets of, let's call them what they are, Russian oligarchs, those who are helping actually Putin to invade and to kill civilians, to kill like whole families in Ukraine. And they also bear their part of responsibility and they also should pay. So German has also something to do, and it won't be even a precedent. Like we understand that in many cases it's very difficult to take leadership. Although when we are talking about Germany, we really expect it to take leadership in Europe. But in this case, Germany should not even be the first one to start. Canada, United States already started this way.
Robin, I'd like to come to you quickly just on something that you were saying earlier. You have mentioned, of course, that you know what sets us apart as democracies is that we can actually have these debates. But one thing that always strikes me about the German debate, and it's coming up again in this particular discussion about whether we seize the full sort of kit and caboodle of Russian assets that are available, or whether we work on some sort of creative solution, as we've been talking about, is the role of international law. Often in German discussions, we tie ourselves up into thinking, oh, it's not legal, and so we better not do it. Whereas, of course, there's different scholars that will dispute that. We don't really get to the point of really saying, okay, well, why do we have this law? You know, what is sort of the moral imperative that this international law is actually designed to uphold? Are we having this debate the wrong way?
That is a characteristic that I like, that we want to act in accordance to international law. I want to act according to law. But acting according to law also means trying to interpret the law and trying to find out what the law is about. That is one of the instruments we have when dealing with law. This is thinking about what is the reason of that. And of course, also part of it is thinking about what do we have to change and what can we change and how is the process of changing that. So I think this is one part of this struggle, that we want to upkeep international law in all of this. But on the other hand, still, it is necessary to make those pay who caused the damage.
Right. And Yulia, I'd like to come to you on this in a second, because you made that very interesting distinction before between an absolute protection, a rigid interpretation of the law, and protecting the rule of law itself. So I'm going to come to you on that in just one second. But Robin, just to follow on upon that a little bit, I'm going to play devil's advocate here. As you know me a little bit, then you know that's something I'm not averse to doing. That desire to have clean hands is very understandable in German context, is very understandable given German history. But hasn't it become more than that? Hasn't it become this restrictive comfort of legalism that is using the rules as a straitjacket not to act for those who don't wish to? Whereas we actually hear other reasons behind this. We hear that Germany has a special relationship with Russia. That's why this can't be done. We hear seizing these assets would make us, quote unquote, as bad as the Russians. Now, that seems to me to be a striking failure in the second example to draw any kind of proportionality between the two acts. And in the first case, that's really worrying for what Germany's relationships, Germany's interests are, and it would be really worrying for Germany's allies if that were the case. So, while I appreciate what you're saying, isn't this being used, the good intentions of that from people like yourself, it's being used by people with other motives?
If it is used in that direction, it would be totally wrong. But once again, I think it's a good thing to have the goal to not be as bad as Russian politics is. I do not want to play in this moral field because this is totally unacceptable. And I want to upkeep and I want to preserve the international law. But we should not have that as an excuse, because we need to have very clear in our minds that we are in a fight of this dictatorship against the idea of democracy. And we are also under attack. And we have to keep that in mind. And so we have to find ways on how to deal in accordance to international law, but take the necessary measures to defend ourselves, our democracies, and on the front line, Ukraine, against this aggression. If there is anyone left in German politics, and I know that there are some left in German politics, so say that we have this special relation to Russia, we definitely still need in this country to work up the mistakes of the past we made. We have to take the necessary lessons of the wrong German politics concerning Russia in the past. We have to learn the lessons that it's not us who understands what is Russia doing best, but our neighbors in Middle and Eastern Europe who knew better in the past and maybe now have the more correct assessments as well. So this is part of our learning process. And I urge everyone in Germany to really try to learn from the mistakes in the past. It was wrong to make these mistakes, but it can happen that you make a mistake. But if you do not learn from these mistakes, then you are doomed.
Absolutely right. And crucial to that is understanding, indeed, we are the ones in the fight as well. And if you're in a fight, you want to win it. And one of the reasons you want to win it, Yulia, is to maintain things like the rule of law, which you mentioned before. Could you talk us through a little bit that distinction that you drew a second ago?
Sure. So I will add on to Robin's point that he's absolutely right. We have had these legal debates over and over. But at this point, 2 years later, experts have come to the realization that the argument that it's illegal under international law doesn't really hold water anymore. And that's also largely because there are several countries who have already legislated based on the principle of countermeasures, including Canada, the US, Switzerland, and Estonia. So let me explain that a little bit. Countermeasures are a well-established doctrine under international law. This is something that already exists. And if you think about it, it would be crazy to say, well, there's nothing we can do to hold Russia accountable to pay the compensation we all agree that it owes. But thankfully, that's not the case. A state only benefits from non-interference with its property rights when it is abiding by international law. In this case, Russia is clearly not. It's invaded Ukraine, it's stolen territory, it's stolen children, and it's committed thousands of war crimes. Russia doesn't now get to benefit from the rule of law for its bank account, at the same time as it violates every single part of it. Property was never meant to have more protections than human rights or more protections than international peace and security. That's not international law. So when Russia stops its war and when it pays the full reparations that it owes, again, a requirement, then it can get this untouchability of its bank account back. That is the whole principle of countermeasures. It's important to understand that this is not an exception to international law. We are not making an exception. This is actually a core part of it. So whenever these arguments do come up and opponents still claim that it's against international law to transfer assets, they haven't really been able to mount a convincing argument as to why that hasn't already been addressed at this point. As to why this argument comes up, I do honestly agree that legal concerns are often used as a get out of making a difficult decision card. It's really an excuse at this point. We don't really need more legal debates. What we need is more political will and a cold, hard reckoning of what will happen if these assets aren't used for Ukraine soon. But really, the bigger picture, I think, is it all boils down to one very quasi-legal point, not really legal. And this point is that, well, this exact same thing hasn't been done before, so therefore something must be wrong with the idea. This way of thinking overlooks the fact that, okay, well, we don't have an exact historical blueprint, and we rarely do in history, but we do have precedent that's very analogous, as Helena mentioned. And we do have well-established legal doctrines that allow for such an asset transfer. It's also important to recognize that international law isn't something that's handed down to us from above on stone tablets. It's not written in stone. It constantly evolves. And what countries and states do and what they how they act and what they permit contributes to that evolvement. And the bigger question is, how do we want it to evolve? And like Aaron said, inaction is just as much a precedent setting evolvement as action is.
Helena, you were just talking a few minutes ago about leadership, and Yulia just mentioned just now the role of the United States, Canadian, Estonian, Swiss legislation on setting the legal precedent that, yes, this is possible because these countries have actually done it. What kind of leadership do we need to see here from countries that are a bit further ahead? So let's go to Canada and the US for a moment. They are way ahead of just about every other country when it comes to actual legislation on this to allow for the seizure of state assets. But both mention on this topic, in Canada's recent budget, there was a note of this. The Repo Act itself seems to signal that neither country wants to really lead on this politically and diplomatically, at least for the moment, but rather tie themselves to whatever G7 consensus ends up being. Where is the leadership on this? What kind of example needs to be set? Is it better to have an example set? And if they were to go ahead, how do you think that would affect this debate and narrative, both for Ukraine and here in Germany?
Well, I believe they are already ahead and they already made the most important steps. So basically they put this as a part of their legislation and they can actually move to the practical steps. The next step should actually be creation of the fund to cover these damages. And once again, I totally agree with Robin, who's my vis-a-vis in Germany as a co-chair, as a chair of Ukraine-German Interparliamentary Friendship Group, but also a great friend of Ukraine, that it's obvious who should pay. I mean, it's fair. It is fair that it's Russians who should pay. So basically the next step, voted by a global community, by United Nations General Assembly, they voted that the next step should be creation of the fund. And the fund obviously should be filled with Russian frozen assets. So now it's time to move on. And for all the countries to actually fulfill this United Nations resolution. Germany have voted.
Yes. Robin, we're going to come to you on that, because indeed the G7 is going to be crucial in this process. And Germany is a member of the G7. Has been having trouble leading in other ways on Ukraine, as we know. And you've been one of the ones pushing for it to do more on every front, but we haven't got there yet. So surely this would be one of the ways where Germany could really demonstrate it is in the fight, it's in it to win it. How do we get there?
Yes, I think we should do that. And the perspective on the G7 is the right one. I think this is really important for this issue to have it in the G7 context, because even with the clear course that I have, I think the thought about what it means for the financial center in the States and things like that, this is a valid argument. And this argument can be countered if we act together in the G7. And when concerning leadership, I think we have to think about what leadership in these times means. And that does not mean being the lonely wolf who walks out alone and does everything on its own. But it has to be leadership within a group and trying to act within this group and working together with the others. But leadership in a group does not mean to wait for everyone else to act, because then no one acts in this group. So someone has to take the initiative in this group. That can be Germany, that can also be others in this group, but as a German politician, I would say we should be more active on that. The Bundestag voted clearly and had this motion that we should use the frozen assets. And so within the G7, we should move a step forward and together solve this issue. This is also part of grown-up politics. I think we cannot always wait for others to deal with the issues. When we want to be grown up in Europe, we cannot always wait for our friends on the other side of the Atlantic to take the leadership on whatever question it is. As I think it's very important that we are strongly together, but we also have to take our share of responsibility.
Exactly. Unity shouldn't mean lowest common denominator or always waiting for the others or settling on the lowest thing we could possibly agree to. It should mean actually going forward for the team purpose and actually playing as a team, letting some lead sometimes, others lead other times, play to their strength. That's absolutely fine. But truth wins out over tranquility in team play as well. And this is something that we have to actually be able to prioritize. That's going to take political leadership, which is where narratives are key, I think, to come into this. But we haven't yet got a narrative from the key leaders in Germany, including Vice Chancellor Habeck and Foreign Minister Baerbock, about seizing these assets and linking it to victory. What we've heard from both of them is that they view this issue critically, or that it would just be viewed in terms of the seizing of the interest rather than the asset itself. Now, we've heard people on Berlin Side Out challenge that before from both the Greens and from the CDU-CSU. But Julio, can you tell us a bit more about this key role of narratives in this struggle for victory?
Specifically, Yulia, let's ask about the Repo Act and also about Canadian legislation, because now that the Repo Act has actually passed and Canadian legislation is closer to passing, are we potentially seeing the opportunity for a narrative change in how this whole thing is framed?
Yes, absolutely. And I'm very glad you asked about that. So I will start with the Repo Act, since that's probably what I'm most familiar with, and it's the most recent development. So yes, the Repo Act does absolutely change the narrative in several really important ways. First, it redraws these false red lines that were set by Europe. It legitimizes the use of countermeasures to seize and transfer the assets themselves, rather than pursue these creative strategies whose whole purpose is to avoid touching the assets. It shows that seizing the assets is possible. And it's also the best way legally and practically to deliver the greatest amount and benefit to Ukraine and therefore to the entire global world in the fastest way. It shows that it is possible to create legal mechanisms if they don't already exist. So it erases this excuse of, oh, well, we don't have the law for that. Well, then make one. That is the job of a lawmaker. Yes, the Repo Act does change the narrative. So does the Canadian legislation. And it also exposes all of these excuses about international law. It makes them come more and more glaringly inconsistent. It explicitly asserts the legality of doing this as a countermeasure against Russia's grave breach of international law. And what's really important is that it was passed unanimously with the support, in other words, of lawmakers from all member countries in Europe and from all of their political families. So in other words, the governing parties of all EU countries have voted for a legal and political position that some of their governments are trying to resist. That is an incredibly important message. So what, in terms of narrative, what this really means is that the position of EU G7 countries is unsustainable. It would serve them better at this point to realize this and to act accordingly rather than be shamed into it by inevitable public pressure once others act, like the US and Canada.
Right. And this is something we've also talked a lot on the show about, is that these things will happen, largely speaking. They will go ahead in that way. So trying to get ahead of that and do this strategically in a proactive manner would be much more in our interest and would actually be much more to the interest of the politicians who did it, rather than claiming it's impossible until it becomes inevitable and then acting in an unplanned fashion that makes us look completely hopeless before our electorates as well, and doesn't exactly signal the resolve that we need, and it doesn't signal to our populations that we've got this, we're in charge, we're in control, we're ready to win a systemic competition against authoritarian regimes. So I think some of the crisis of political legitimacy that we're seeing in the West is partly related to this failure to accept actually what are strategic inevitabilities and to really claim them and take ownership of them. But that's something, Helena, that Ukraine has been incredibly good at doing. Ukrainian leaders have been incredibly good at getting ahead of the game on this and continuing to push, be it in narrative terms, be it in ways of appealing to the conscience of the West and so on, to appealing to the times when Western countries have been at their best, actually, and have lived up to their values and have served their interests. But at the same time, we now start to see difficulties in Ukraine continuing to push forward. Can you tell us a little bit about how that feels and why the fight for victory in Ukraine must go on, and what message you would deliver to our listeners around European countries and across the Atlantic as to why Ukraine must win?
One thing that I really want to say, that I want to be heard, that for Ukraine, it's very heartbreaking that we managed to get additional, for example, military assistance or additional legal or political tool on a table only after actually a new tragedy in Ukraine or atrocities or stuff like that. We've been begging for military assistance, like for serious weapon to protect ourselves since the beginning of full-scale invasion. But only after April, after Russians left from the northern regions, and when the whole world saw all those, not only dead, but tortured people laying on the streets, that's what Russians did to civilians. Only after that, some activities have started. Talking about the recent activities, in March, Russians have started basically ruining and destroying the huge energy stations in Ukraine. There was this one energy station It just says that the air alarm in Kyiv is out. So we are kind of safe again. But that's the typical, that's our routine. That's how we live. So actually, there was an air alarm. Yeah. But nevertheless, so Russians have actually ruined the huge electricity plant that supplied energy to three regions, including Kyiv, but two other major big regions. And only after that, some activities have started taking place related to air defense. So American Congress finally voted the military assistance, the $61 billion. And we also see, we are very thankful, but it is kind of like a delayed assistance from Germany as well.
Well, exactly. This is an argument we've actually made quite a lot on the show and here in Berlin. Why was it that Ukrainians had to wait for Bucha to happen in order to get artillery? Why did Mariupol have to be razed to the ground in order for HIMARS to be sent? And we see it again this time. What has triggered the passing of the Ukraine aid bill but an Iranian attack on Israel? Let's be frank. This is actually what tipped the tipped this over the edge. So another total strategic fail from the collective West, from the democratic world. We're letting our enemies, our adversaries, the enemies of freedom, set the agenda. We are clearly on the back foot and playing catch up. So we need to start getting ahead of that. And it's therefore very unfortunate that in Germany, still the conversation it revolves around questions like, what if Kharkiv were to suffer the same fate as Mariupol? Would that move Olaf Scholz to send Taurus? And it's totally the wrong way of looking at this, of course. I actually personally think it wouldn't, because I don't think it fits with Scholz's strategic logic. But nonetheless, even thinking about it in those terms is totally wrong, I find. Yulia, could you just tell us a little bit about that strategic situation in Washington and the passing of the act? Because you've been on the ground there.
Yes, I completely agree with Helena that I'm very glad that it passed. Finally, it took 8 months of long, sustained effort of trying literally everything on the hundreds of congressional meetings. An entire Ukrainian action summit where 500 Ukrainian-American delegates flew in from 47 states across the country for a weekend to meet with their congressional representatives and to advocate for Ukraine aid. And so much more. Discharge petitions, media campaigns, putting up billboards, news ads. This was a monumental effort for something that should be very obvious. And in the end, bringing it back to the seized assets, I believe it's the same. The seized assets is going to be the same in the long list of decisions around Javelins, MiG-29s, T-72s, HIMARS, Leopards, F-16s, all of those things. Our Western decision makers try and avoid doing the obvious, but eventually they're left with no choice but to do what they need to do. But it's always too little and it's too late. And Ukraine always pays in the blood of its brave soldiers and its innocent civilians. At the very core, it really boils down to the fact that our decision makers consistently fail to understand the threat from Russia and the risks if Ukraine is allowed to fail.
I think Europeans still, in particular, still haven't woken up to the fact that we are far more directly exposed and drastically vulnerable to a continued Russian threat, that if we don't defeat that in Ukraine, it can be coming for us. And is it then going to be again a case of us saying, oh, we really need to rearm ourselves when one of the Baltic states is attacked, or when a city in Poland suffers the same fate as Mariupol, or when the missiles start landing on Munich? And this is the thing, if we're still having this too late approach, if we're not ahead of the game, that's precisely what we risk. And I think that's the stakes we have to be laying out in front of our decision makers. But Aaron, there's more to this than just military rearmament. There's an economic front as well, as we discussed at the beginning, isn't there?
Absolutely. And that's precisely where this whole question of seizing the assets actually comes in. It's this question of, you know, who should pay for this? Obviously, Russia should pay for this. And it's irresponsible, as we've said many times, to leave Russian money on the table when Ukraine continues to pay in blood, obviously, as Yulia just said, but also that the Western taxpayer continues to be on the hook for supporting Ukraine, which, you know, is in our interest, let's be clear. But at a time of economic uncertainty, it's quite strange that we are leaving this money on the table, which, as Yulia has mentioned, we can legally take and transfer to Ukraine. the longer we put off this decision, as you've said, Ben, the more likely it is that the result will be more expensive, that we'll actually have to spend more and more money on defense because the Russian threat will become ever, ever closer to home for us. So this seems to be a rather no-brainer decision. One thing we do hear, in addition to some of the legal counter-arguments, is economic counter-arguments, which Robin has addressed a little bit, that can be mitigated by moving forward as the G7. And that's why he favors this. But there's concerns, of course, that if we were to seize the assets, that there would be the potential to destabilize the euro or any other Western currency or create the possibility for Russia to retaliate. Now, let's be clear here. Western currencies that the G7 has jurisdiction over make up 89% of currency reserves in the world. So I'm always very skeptical of this particular argument. Let's be frank there. But Yulia, Helena, what do you make of these arguments?
Prominent economists and experts have already shown that these concerns are largely overblown, and they're kind of a scaremongering tactic for the reasons that Aaron explained, is that if the G7 moves together, this is 89.2% of the world's reserve currencies. There's literally no place else to go. The other reason is that any negative effects that would have happened from taking these reserves would have already been triggered when the G7 froze those assets in early 2022. That is arguably the bigger move, but there have been no observed consequences. And this is because the G7, by freezing those reserves and stating that they will remain frozen until Russia pays a sum that is greater than the amount that they're holding, they've already made it clear that aggressors' reserves are not safe in the G7, and nor should they be. I think the bigger point, too, I will make is that the bigger risk on this reserve currency front is not necessarily the financial component, and it's really been framed in this economic financial way. But the bigger risk is if the West fails to adequately fund Ukraine, and that results in it losing the war or not being able to sustain itself. That would actually be a bigger seismic hit to the security of Europe, where inevitably Russia will invade next. And this would deplete confidence, not in just the euro, but in the stability of Europe itself. So in the end, Euroclear and the banks should not be the decision makers here. This isn't a financial decision. It's a national security decision. And it's one that really should be made with Western national security interests at the core. And policymakers need to start realizing this. And they need to stop offsetting their decisions onto bankers and actually fulfill their roles as policymakers and international experts.
Right. I mean, this really echoes that discussion we heard in Germany at the beginning of the full-scale war as well, when it was talked of, you know, Germany will have to get off Russian gas. No, said some big businesses, this will lead to Massenarbeitslosigkeit, or mass unemployment, a terror word in the German lexicon that brings back images of the 1920s, which are then seen to have led to Hitler's rise. This was deliberate scaremongering, which did not reflect an accurate calculation of the risk or an ability to weigh up the different risks involved, as Yulia just said. So we shouldn't give in to that. Again, Helena, would you like to add anything on that?
In a time when crazy things are happening, and it's impossible to stay in the same modus operandi. Time changes and we have to change with them. We can't, we have to answer the challenges that occur. And that's why it's important to come up with new solutions, with creative ways to approach the things and stuff like that. And once again, this is just another argument to be added to the basket with arguments about why Russians' assets should be seized. Yeah, like this was not done before, but okay, we didn't have basically invasions and atrocities like that over the previous, 80 years. And if we don't want situations like that happen in the future, there should be new solutions, there should be new answers, and they should be like really, tough. And serious.
I think adapting to the times is essential, and not just relying on the old tools that were for a very different situation. All of this brings three things to mind that I think we should use to concentrate our minds and concentrate the conversation. We've shown this inability to calculate and weigh different risks against each other. that needs to change. So we have to be able to understand the consequences, again, as Aaron said before, of inaction, or the consequences of different forms of action, rather than just fixating on one kind of risk. We haven't realized it's our fight. And thus it's our fight to win, because if you're in that fight, you need to win it. And the third part of that is because I think we haven't realized our power. We're actually afraid of our power. And this is something that Christianis Karinch said to us in Munich as well. He said, we need to embrace our strength. If we realize we're in a fight, we embrace our strength and we start properly calculating risks, then we have the basis to proceed in a strategic fashion that can actually ensure our security, as Yulia said. And that starts in Ukraine, but it doesn't end there for Europeans nor for the rest of the democratic world. And we have to really get ahead of that. And as Robin Wagner said, act as a team to do that and bring our different qualities to bear and leverage them by working properly together.
You've been talking about power just a second ago, Ben, that we are afraid of our own power. By seizing the entirety of this $300 billion in assets, when we have 89% of the world's currency reserves, that is certainly a demonstration of economic power, not simply military power. And I think too often we think of Ukraine and Russia's war against it only in military terms. We have to remember that this involves every thing that we're able to do. That's why we're having this particular discussion on the seizure of assets. So when it comes to precedent and the power to set a precedent by using this particular power, I'd like to come back to one line of one book that's a bit old at the moment, but it's Mark Leonard's Why Europe Will Run the 21st Century. One line, I think, of that book that has that is still interesting today is when he says Europe's weapon is the law. Well, if that is in fact true, then this is a step that we need to actually take to actually prove it, to use the rule of law, to uphold the rule of law, and to say that there are consequences for not upholding the rule of law. And one of those consequences is that we will seize your assets.
In a thesis from that book that is otherwise aged like milk, Aaron, I think you've managed to find a little bit of cream to hold on to. And of course, Europe needs to complement its legal weapon with its economic weapon, and finally, to find some military weapons to go with it, to have the full array of power at our disposal in order to stand up for that free world, in order to stand up and make sure that we understand that our fight for victory in the systemic competition runs through victory in Ukraine, which is our common victory.
Thank you so much to Helena Yanchenko, Robin Wagner, and Yulia Siskina for being with us today. Joining us now from Ottawa is Canadian Senator Ratna Omidvar, who has been working with experts like Yulia on the Canadian legislation for seizing Russian state assets. Welcome to the show, and thank you for joining us.
So, Senator, Canada and the U.S. are way ahead of just about every other country when it comes to actual legislation and a framework, a legal framework, to seize Russian assets. But if we look at Canada's recent budget, it really seems to signal a bit of a walk back from some of the tough talk that we've seen on this whole theme of seizing Russian assets really since the invasion. Now it seems that the government here wants to tie itself to whatever G7 consensus is. So where is Canadian leadership on this question?
I believe Canada is a world leader on this file. We were the first to propose seizure of assets of oligarchs. We were the first to actually try and walk through the process. We're in court. We have to get it completely right so that any seizures that are affected under the law can be more nimble and more flexible at this point than they are. The budget also clearly states that Canada's current position is that Russian state assets can be used. And it is within the framework of the law that Canada accepts the findings of international lawyers that we can use those Russian state assets. Now, Aaron, I must say that the budget, at least in Canada, is always a bit of an aspirational statement. It lays out a few directions, but the guts of the budget we will see in June when the Budget Implementation Act is tabled. And a few things have happened since Canada's budget came out. And I agree with you that Canada did say we want to work in collaboration with our allies. The Repo Act was passed in the US. And I believe this may add some wind to our sails, that in fact, we too need to anchor our capacity already to use countermeasures which under international law, but to anchor them in domestic legislation so that it is more fail-safe. So I'm still very much hoping that in this time between now and June, that our government looks at what the United States is doing and seeks now to emulate the United States. But I believe it is the pathway that is being created both by the US and RIPO and eventually, I hope, by Canada, that will give comfort to others who are more risk averse, who are regionally more vulnerable, let me put it this way. So I think seeking solidarity in sanctions regimes, solidarity always works when, sanctions may be nation-based, but when six or seven nations do that, then it has an impact. So I'm still, you can hear in my voice, Aaron, I'm still hopeful that Canada will follow the example of the United States now. We had always hoped that the United States would follow Canada.
Senator, let me follow up on that there, because I think this is extremely important. Obviously, unity is a concept that is talked about a lot among the allies and is prized as a good in itself. But if it's unity around the lowest common denominator, it's not good enough for our current circumstance. We need unity around the highest common factor. So what does Canada actually expect from those allies that you mentioned who are more risk averse, but who have more assets that could be seized?
I believe Canada as a middle power wants to be seen leading in this fight. And we have led in this fight for the last number of years. Others have followed us. In the case of repurposing Russian state assets, I agree completely that seizing the state assets and letting Ukraine fight its just war with Russian money as opposed to Canadian taxpayer money or US taxpayer money is far more just. It also enables us to get to scale in terms of money quickly. There is, after all, $350 billion. And most importantly, it doesn't encumber the Ukraine to the extent into the future in a post-war economy in a way that maybe collateralizing or securitizing those assets would. I know that there seemed to be two ideas moving at some pace. You know, I'm certainly hoping that Canada will have a Churchill moment on this and embrace, for me, I'm an individual senator. What I say or do is really not government policy. It's what I'm proposing. And I'm certainly hoping that the government between now and the tabling of the Budget Implementation Act stiffens its spine a little and does what is right, easy, quick, fast, and does not encumber Ukraine into the future.
So let's talk a little bit about something that you brought up a second ago, which is the U.S. Repo Act, which, of course, the U.S. Is the first country that has passed domestic legislation allowing for the seizure of Russian state assets. I, of course, as a Canadian myself, was kind of hoping we'd be first, but perhaps going second isn't such a terrible thing either. If we do see, as you're saying, something in the Budget Implementation Act in June or anything up until then, what do you think Canadian legislation might do if Canada does have its Churchill moment and chooses to lead to that narrative? I mean, the Repo Act certainly seems to change that narrative. Does that give us sort of more impetus to kind of find our Churchill moment? And what do you think that would do to the overall narrative, especially because perhaps Europeans would sit there and say, well, of course the US is going to do this, but Canada, you know, it's a country that is well renowned for its respect for international law. It's maybe a little bit harder to ignore. What do you think Canada's role could be there?
I believe Canada's role would be in carving a pathway in terms of domestic legislation and helping other countries craft their own pathway. I had begun to hear that Switzerland was pretty keen on this idea, as is the UK. Everybody's positions now seem to be getting more nuanced a little and shifting a little. So I think between now and the next G7 moment is a time for those of us who want to work on the asset seizure side to really amplify and ramp up our work.
Right, indeed. And that's also something that allies are asking from Canada too, other allies, because as much as the pocket brigade that Canada has deployed to Latvia is appreciated in the region, it's not a full brigade. And also Canada's not paying its way in NATO. 1.29% of GDP on defense spending is not where Canada needs to be on that. So to truly be on the team for the victory of democracies against autocracies, I think there's a lot of eyes on Ottawa to say, if you're not leading militarily or even not paying your way militarily, where is your leadership and your contribution coming from?
I think Canadians would dispute the implicit conclusion that you are making, Benjamin, in that statement. Canadians see themselves very much on the side of the Ukrainians. For a country and an economy of our size, we have, and I'm not going to use the word generous because generous is patronizing. We have provided help to the Ukraine in different ways. I won't talk about the light armored vehicles, for instance, and I know the number is small, but I heard from a Ukrainian parliamentarian last week in Ottawa that getting the donation of the light armored vehicles opened up the pathway for the U.S. to provide Strikers, because the Ukraine could demonstrate that he was able to deal with, service, and use those LAVs, which are the same technology as the U.S. Strikers, I believe they are called. So I we're never going to be the largest donors to Ukraine because we don't have the size of the economy that, let's say, the U.S. has or Germany has. But we can lead with good ideas. Now, in this case, you know, I'm certainly going to do everything I can to give the Canadian government, as best as I can, along with the help of podcasts like this, that the easiest, quickest, fastest, most just route to help Ukraine fight this war is to seize those assets. Now, maybe we need to de-risk this idea. I've become, very conscious of the word risk and risk aversion as I have worked on this file. So, you know, snatching $350 billion at one fell swoop is spooky, perhaps. So perhaps what we can do instead is develop a schedule of asset confiscation, which is open, transparent. It accelerates with time at set intervals, unless Russia is able, to meet certain conditions. So that provides a certain amount of predictability that we will take the first 10% then, and we will take the next 20% then. And so it that may help to de-risk this whole, idea. And there are a lot of vultures, if I may say, around this proposal, around what happens to G7 assets that are stranded in Russia. And already we've heard that Russia is, taking the assets of one country or the other way. But if we are only going to view this as a transactional measure, that, we'll take this and they'll take that, we'll never get back to the heart of what the real question is, which is how do we preserve the global order by securing safety and security for Ukraine? Because if we let Ukraine fall, then I believe there will be other countries next. And that's what we have to stop.
And I think seizing the assets certainly plays a huge role in that, partly to give Ukraine the amount of cash that it needs right now to be able to actually win this war, not simply to put it off, to some reconstruction that happens we don't know when, and that presupposes the outcome of the war, which we don't know yet. So I really do see the potential for Canadian and other leadership on this particular question. But we have to, want to win. This is, and this is certainly would be a big step in doing that. It seems, though, that we have to find the will to do that. The legislative framework is there. This is legal under international law. We just have to find the political will to do it. As you said, the Churchill moment.
It all comes down to those two words, political will. And political will, I've been in the political arena for some time, and I can say with some experience that political will is always strengthened when you have more than one in the room. And I believe that is what Canada may well be looking for now with the United States in the room. Let's also remember the U.S. legislation, as Canada's proposed legislation that I have tabled, doesn't doesn't force the government to use the instrument. It enables the government to do something if they so choose to do.
Absolutely. So that's also a task for allies, to make sure that Canada doesn't feel alone in doing this, make sure that there is the political will. And that comes from two sources. It comes from encouragement and motivation, but also from pressure. There's sticks and there's carrots here. And I think that being clear about who's contributing to this fight and who isn't is part of that discussion. Senator, we are delighted to have had you with us today on Berlin Side Out to discuss your proposed legislation and the need for Canada to step up and to, not only having made this legal, paved the way, but to actually follow through and blaze that trail for others to actually follow in showing that will that it will be needed to win.
Thank you so much to our panelists for joining us today on part two of our Pillars of Victory special, focusing on the financial measures we need to win. Thank you also to our technical producer, Hendrik Vanna, and our project assistant, Judith Stückle. Stay tuned for the rest of our season as we get through the real strategic turning point that Germany needs, and we give you a sneak peek at what's next for us at Berlin Side Out. Until then, from Berlin, auf Wiedersehen and tschüss.